Take me where the promises are real.
Let's have an AA meeting, y'all.
Let's have one.
My name is Mike Boatwright, and I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday night New Year's Eve Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the NAVA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or a lot more of sobriety tells his or her story. We'll start with this reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describe in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish a relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing counts in bad taste. Our hope is that alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker. We believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. I had completely forgotten tonight that our speaker was speaking. And when I walked in, I was like, oh, that's right. I'm so glad. Because I've known this guy longer than I've known just about. Well, I've known this guy longer than I've been in AA. Not longer than he's been in AA, but not by much. Chet was getting sober when I was doing my best drinking, running around acting like a crazy man at Georgia Tech. And I worked for Chet. So my buddy and I were kind of like working the first step for Chet the whole time. I think we kept him sober for a couple of years there with our craziness. Anyway, I walked into a meeting one day and there he was. And I've heard his story several times now. And he's spoken at my anniversary before. I love this guy to death. This is we're in for a treat. He's been around for a long time. And without any further ado, I give you to my dear friend Chet.
Hey everybody, my name is Chet, and I am an alcoholic.
Hey, Chet.
And it's good to see everybody here tonight. There's two people here tonight. Hey, Mickey, that I knew before I got into the program, and he was one of them, right? But everybody else I've met since I've been here. I think a good reason for that is because I didn't do a lot of drinking with other drunks. I was a loner a good part of my drinking career. But my drinking career ended on March 22nd of 1978. And it may not impress some of you all, but it still tickles my wife to death. and she's a good member of Al-Anon. I'm a member of the We've Had Enough group, which in itself sounds like a political movement, but it's We've Had Enough Drinking is what it's supposed to stand for, but it meets every Tuesday night over at the Biscayne Room. And I love the group. I've been a member of that group for over 39 years now. And it was until recently listed as a young people's meeting. And I know I don't look young. But the interesting thing was that when I got old, they didn't ask me to leave, because it's AA. And we still attract a lot of young people there. But there's also a lot of us, probably I think about 10 of us now, that have 30 or more years in that group. And so it's a really good, strong group that tries to talk about recovery every Tuesday night. And I enjoy being there. I'm not going to give you much of a drunkalogue. I am going to try to mention a few things that will probably ring a few bells for some of you. I never intended to be a drunk. Never intended winding up in AA. It makes me think of a speaker I heard a few years ago that when he got up to speak, he says, I want to welcome all of you to Plan B. Because Plan A didn't work, right? And I understand that. because it wasn't my plan A, you know. But I'm very grateful that Alcoholics Anonymous was here when I needed it. I started drinking when I was in my second year of college. I grew up in Kentucky, and I was down at Western Kentucky, and I was studying chemistry and math and just enjoying myself, and somewhere through the second year of school. And I was making very good grades, and I really wanted to succeed. I think there was only one person in my father's side of the family or my mother's side of the family that had gone to college, and she had gotten a two-year degree, and that was all it took to teach up in the mountains of Kentucky at that time. But I wanted to be the first one to get through college, and sure enough, I thought that I should probably upgrade my social life by joining a fraternity. And I had no intention of drinking. I just went to see what was going on. I didn't know much about the what a fraternity did. I understood they had parties and had a good time, but I went there, and a guy came up and offered me a beer, and I said, no, thank you. I was raised Southern Baptist. You know, they'd take this stand against drinking, which later became a problem for me. But I said, no, I thank you, appreciate it, but I'm not interested. And after standing around for about an hour or so, you know, how your throat gets real parched and dry. You know, you're trying to act cool, and you can't swallow. And, you know, I was not a leader of the band, so to speak, when it came to social things. And so I noticed that there was a keg of beer. I don't think I'd ever seen a keg of beer, but those people were coming over and they were hitting the tap and they were getting this beer out of it. So I thought, well, I'll just go over and try one. And it was cold. The last time I'd even tasted beer was when I was in high school, and there was a bunch of guys sitting on a football field in July. And it gets pretty hot up in Kentucky. It was up in the 90s. And these guys have been sitting under this tree for a while drinking, and they had a case of long neck 12-ounce bottles, and apparently they had been sitting there for quite some time, because they said, you want a beer? And of course I was going to act cool, and they handed me a beer, and that thing was hotter than I was. And I tried to drink it, and I thought, oh, this stuff is awful, you know. But on this particular night in this fraternity, they offered me a beer, and I tried some, and it was cold, and it tasted good, and it was wet. And long story short, I don't know how many I drank that night. In fact, I don't remember a good part of that night. I don't remember driving home. I do remember something about driving home, though, because I thought this stuff was wonderful, and I took two or three cups and put it up on the dash of my car and drove home and got my roommate to come out and carry some of these cups of beer up, you know. I didn't know if I was ever going to get any more, you know. And I woke up next morning with my first hangover. And that should have been enough to convince me that this is not the way to go. If I was normal, that I should add that. It was one of those things that was life-changing, actually. Because when I drank, all of the problems that I had with meeting people and being afraid somebody would find something wrong with me or whatever. I'm afraid to get out on the dance floor because I'd probably make the wrong move or whatever. All that disappeared when I started drinking. I didn't care what they thought. I'd go up and talk to anybody, and it was not a problem. And it was a really life-changing matter as far as I was concerned. And I liked doing it. In fact, within just a month or so, I was getting drunk four and five nights a week. And the only problem with that, of course, is that you can't take the subjects I was taking and pass them when I was spending that much time drinking. And by the time I realized that I was probably not going to be able to pass my courses, I just dropped out early. And instead of going back and trying to make good on my efforts there, I decided to change schools. Now, I didn't know it until later, until I got here, that this is typical alcoholic behavior. Yeah, if it doesn't go well in one place, go someplace else, you know, instead of standing there trying to fix the situation at hand. So I went to another school. They call it Big Blue up there, University of Kentucky. I was there when Adolph Rupp was still coaching basketball, and it was a lot of fun there. But I did something that, looking back on it, was kind of extraordinary. I decided that I wasn't going to give up drinking. I mean, that didn't make sense. But I would drink on weekends and give myself during the week to do all the schoolwork I needed to do. And consequently, I passed everything. Not with flying colors, but I passed everything. I did a lot of drinking on weekends. In fact, the first blackout I can remember that I knew that I had, which just startled me when it happened, because I thought I didn't understand it. I was at a bar and on a Saturday night, and I remember ordering a few drinks, and next thing I know, I decided it must be time to get up and go back to the dormitory, and got ready to pay the bill, and I saw these glasses in front of me, and I thought, who put these glasses here? And then when I paid the bill, I realized they were mine, you know. And I thought it was probably about 9:30, and it was almost 12. And I don't know who I talked to, or if I talked to anybody, or what I did or said, or anything like that. But I thought that for a while, but I went out drinking the next weekend anyway, right? You know, when you're as young as I was, and you're just early on fighting this, I didn't know I had a disease. I didn't know anything about alcoholism. But I remember thinking after that year, I'd run out of money, basically. So I moved back to Louisville to live with my parents and go to the University of Louisville. And after getting in there, I realized that I was already about a half a year behind. And I had my senior year coming up, and I thought, you know, I'm not going to be able to make this if I do this. So I gave up drinking altogether. Did some strange things then. I went back to the church. I had not spent a lot of time in church when I had been drinking. And I it's hard to be spiritual and drunk at the same time. I figured that one out. It was during this period of time that I met the young lady I was to marry. She didn't know anything about my drinking. But sure enough, I didn't drink for over 2 years. And I got my degree. I started teaching school. We got married, and she had a job. And I was teaching high school, and I would go to, we'd get out about 3 o'clock, and I would usually go out and play like 9 holes of golf or play some tennis or something, and then pick up my wife at 5:30. And this one particular day, at lunchtime, I and a few of the other teachers were talking about something. I had no idea what it was, but it seemed important enough to continue that discussion after school. And they said, "Let's meet down here at this corner tavern." And I said, "That's fine." I met down there. And since I walked in the door, there was 3 of them sitting there, and they were talking to the waitress. And I was just going to get Coke. Hadn't had a drink in over 2 years. And I walked in there, and somebody said, "Just make it a pitcher and 4 glasses." Now, I could have spoken and said, "You know, that's not what I want." What my head said was, "That sounds pretty good. You're an adult now. You're married. You got a job. You got a degree. Everything's going your way. Yeah, have a beer." I did. Within about a week and a half of that, I was out with a friend of her oldest brother. There was 2 of us on 1 motorcycle. We went to someplace in downtown Louisville I've never been to before nor since. Only I can tell you about it is what he drank that night and what I drank, and I don't remember the ride home. But I do remember is the next morning I was laying across the foot of our bed with the clothes still on that I had the night before. And my wife was trying to get me up to go teach school. And she was laughing about it. One of the few times she laughed when I drank. But that was the first time she had seen me drunk. And shortly after that, interestingly enough, a company came through town and said they were hiring for people to work with computers. And they were looking for mathematicians. And my wife said, why don't you go down there and see what they offer? Well, I did, and I went through their examination and everything. And They made me an offer, and I came back and told my wife about it. They sent me a letter about 10 days later, and I said, look at this. I said, they're offering me more than you and I make together. I said, what do you think? I said, well, let's give it a try. We moved to upstate New York. It didn't look that far on the map, but it's above the Mason-Dixon line, and it's up where it really gets cold. And the only thing I can really tell you about that period of time was that my drinking just got worse, slowly worse. There were some nights that I didn't make it home. There was one night that I drove into a snowbank, and I guess I'm glad that I was drunk enough that I didn't think about turning on the car engine to keep warm. I just simply passed out in the back seat. I don't know why I was in the back seat, to tell you the truth. I was by myself. But I woke up in the back seat, and it was sunlight, and I got out, and I tried to rock the car out, and I think somebody gave me a little hand, and the car was just fine. I started up and drove on home. I told my wife about it. I'd spent the night in a snowdrift, and she said, oh, you poor thing. I put myself there, you know. It just slowly got worse, and one night in the summer, we'd been there for about 4 years, and it was in August, and they had the weather report and said it's supposed to be 38 degrees. And I said, 38 degrees in August? Now, the winter before, there was one period of 6 days where we got like 10 or 15 inches every day, and it just packed down. I remember there was 35 inches of snow standing on my front yard. And it was fun. I just couldn't drive my car anywhere. I couldn't even get it out of the garage. But when they said it was going to be 38 degrees in August, I looked at my wife and said, I think we ought to move south. And the only place that we could consider was Atlanta, because that's where my wife's oldest brother had moved. And so we decided to transfer down here. And after about 4 years with that company, you know, my general story that I tell everybody else was that it was time to go to graduate school. And actually, the truth of the matter is that I left this company before they fired me because my drinking was catching up with me. But I did go to graduate school, and that's where I ran into Mike. And the last couple of years, we're entering the dark years of my drinking now. The last couple of years that I was with this company, things got bad, and then I left that company and things got worse. A lot of times I wouldn't make it home. That's when the DUIs started in 1974 and 75, and I wound up spending nights in jail. And things you didn't want to talk about with the church crowd on Sunday morning, you know. It just got out of hand. And most of this time I was drinking by myself. And I remember one night, one weekend in May of 77, or close to May, last weekend in April, I guess, I started drinking with some people, which I rarely did, and I saw them drinking, and I saw this one girl in particular that was drinking about the way I was drinking, and she was popping some pills, and saw her get really, really, really sick, and I thought she was going to die. I thought we ought to call an ambulance or something. And for an instant, I looked at her, and I saw me, and it scared me. And so I got home a little bit early that night. It was just about 1 in the morning. And the next day I got up and I called AA. Now, why did I call AA? I can't tell you. I didn't know anybody in AA. I didn't have any AA literature. And my wife was not one of those people who would slip AA literature in my briefcase or anything like that. You know, I just didn't know anybody. But something told me to call AA. And now, I will say this. About a month before this happened, my life was, on the surface, I guess, it looked pretty good to most people, but on the inside, it was like it was crumbling apart. And I remember being over at church one day, and I went into the prayer area they had, and I remember praying. I was there by myself, and I remembered praying, God, I don't know what to do. I just need some help. Help me. And I didn't think about that until I had probably been sober for a year or so. I said, you know, I remember praying that prayer, and I wound up in AA. Now, I can tell you this, on my first four-step inventory, I had a lot of resentment against the church. One of them being is, why couldn't they have fixed me? Why did I have to come to AA, you know? And looking back on it, I realized that those people were not equipped to handle Chet. You know, they just weren't. And by taking that inventory, I realized after I read it and looked down and took a fifth step that there was no blame there. But anyway, they told me about a meeting that was right here in this very room on Monday night. It was May 2nd of 1977, and they had a young people's meeting here. I was still pretty young then. And I went to that meeting not knowing what to expect. I thought, well, I need to dress up and, look good. And I thought I'd be running into, you know, if it's a AA meeting, there'd probably be a lot of drunks that had wine sores, you know, they were coming in from the street and so on. And so I walked in there that night, and there was two groups of people. There was this one group where everybody was having fun, hugging each other and laughing and joking around. And the other group was me. You know, I had no idea what they were talking about or what they were doing. I do remember somebody at the very end of the meeting said they were handing out chips. I didn't know what they were, but the guy next to me, he said, "You're new, right?" And I said, "Yeah." He says, "Go up and get your chip." So I did. And so I got my first white chip right here in this room. And you know what? I don't think I've ever told my story in this room since then. That was back, goodness, almost 41 years ago. No, almost 42 years ago. But I didn't know much about it. I really appreciate newcomers' meetings nowadays. I wish they had had a lot more of them back when I first got in, because they talked about the big book. I thought they were talking about the Bible. I really did. And they kept saying, well, it says this in the big book. I kept thinking, where is that in the book? You know, I've never seen that. I didn't know that there were other meetings that I could go to. I thought once I came and started going to this group, I didn't know I could go to other meetings and see other groups and so on. After about a month or so, somebody said, you need to get some phone numbers. I said, okay, I can do that. So I got two phone numbers. Went back to the Monday night meeting the next week, and the guy said, I saw him, and I walked up to him, and I said, hey, I got two phone numbers. He looked at me and said, did you call them? And I said, no. He said, well, call them this week. Well, I happened to get a number of a guy and a number of a gal that was there. Manny was the guy. If any of y'all remember Manny, who was here back in the 80s, early 80s, Manny Banks, he passed away a few years ago. He moved out to Las Vegas and ultimately became the delegate for the state of Nevada out there, good AA member. But his was one of the numbers that I had gotten, and I called him. He says, who's this? And I said, it's Chet. He says, who's Chet? And I started describing myself. He says, oh, I know who you are. Yeah, I've seen you. And he says, what do you want? And I said, I don't know. And he said, well, call me back when you do. And he hung up. You know, and he came back through town. It's probably about 8 or 10 years ago now, but he visited the Biscayne Room, and I heard he was over there. I went over just to shake his hand. And I said, do you remember back when I first got into AA what you told me? And he didn't remember it, but I told him about it. And he just looked at me and laughed. He says, well, you stayed sober, didn't you? Actually, I didn't, but, you know. But I didn't know much about the program, and if you really want a prescription for failure, I can give it to you. I did not have a sponsor. I did not work the steps. I did not have a copy of the big book, nor did I read it. And I guess I was trying to get sober by hanging around with a bunch of sober people. I used to call that getting sober through osmosis, you know. And that doesn't work. It doesn't work. Being around sober people is a nice thing to do. But that will not get you sober. You have to take some action in order to get sober. After about 5 months, because of work schedule, I was putting in sometimes 80 hours or more per week trying to get a project done. And so I stopped going to meetings, and my wife said something about, haven't you been to a meeting? And I said, no, I'm okay. And sure enough, right about Thanksgiving, a guy that I knew, a gal that I worked with, she and her husband came over just to visit. It was Thanksgiving weekend, I guess. And they brought the makings of eggnog. And I like eggnog. And they were making this up, and the guy pulls out a half pint of whiskey. Now, buying a half pint in the first place ought to tell you something, you know. But he opens this thing up, and he starts measuring how much goes in. Now, we have this big thing, and he's measuring how much goes in, and I'm thinking, my God, man, pour that stuff in there, you know. There was just enough in there to flavor it. There wasn't enough alcohol in there to even give somebody a buzz. It was for the flavoring of it. And he put the lid back on and put it back in his pocket. And, of course, I drank a couple of cups of that, and I didn't even feel it. I did taste it. But, you know, that's all it takes for an alcoholic. With what's going through the wheels up here, they start turning and say, you know, I took a drink and it didn't bother me. About a week and a half later, I was going to Florida to work on a project at Eglin Air Force Base. Excuse me. And sure enough, I got down there. The first day was fine. The next day, somebody had to fly back to Atlanta. And so I said, he said, we needed a ride to the airport. And I said, I'll give him one. And on our way over, we decided to stop and have some Mexican food. And I ordered mine and ordered a glass of water, and he ordered his and a beer. And before the waitress got away, I said, make mine a beer too. And that's all it took was that little sip of that eggnog. And sure enough, once again, I don't remember the whole night. I don't remember what I said or did. I remember waking up with another hangover. And so I came back to Atlanta and didn't pick up a white chip. I did decide to go to some meetings down there where I was working, and I went to a couple of meetings, and there was just a bunch of old retired Air Force people, mostly, that were going there to meetings and so on. And it wasn't anything like the meetings we had here in Atlanta, where I saw a lot of young people at that period of time. And so I decided that I would just go to meetings in Atlanta. Of course, I was only coming home like every second or third weekend. And that's not enough, especially if you're not working a program to begin with. That's just not enough. And sure enough, after about 3 months of this, I came home one weekend and we had just gotten a cat. And my wife showed more attention to that damn cat than she did to me, you know. And don't get me wrong, I like cats, but this one was taking my place, you know. And I remember driving back down there to in Fort Walton Beach, Florida. And I've heard people talk about slips. I've never had a slip. You know, I had a resentment. That's better than a slip, you know. And I thought about that all week. And sure enough, on Friday, which was St. Patrick's Day, I decided to go out and have a few beers. Of course, if you're going to have a few beers, you may as well have 2 6-packs, right? So I bought them the night before. Didn't drink any of them. I was in a hotel room. I put them in a plastic trash can. And Friday morning before I went into work, I went down and got as much ice as I could get to put over those beers and leave them in the room. And when I got off of work, I was ready and so were they, and I started drinking. And what I hadn't planned on was that I went on a 5-day drunk, not knowing everything that I did. I went to work 2 of those days and don't remember what I did. And normally that wouldn't be a big deal, but I was in charge of the computer programming of a missile simulator for the Air Force. and I don't know what I did. That young laugh about it now, but I was really worried there for a while. You know, I thought, what did I do? The good news is that it continues to run to this day, so, you know. Apparently I have better results with computers than I did with people. But I remember waking up, and this is the important point, I remember waking up on that morning of March 22nd of 1978, and I looked myself in the mirror, and I, from the deepest part of my gut, I remember looking at myself and saying, I can't do this anymore. And I reached the bottom. I said, I can't do this anymore. The only thing I knew to do was to go back to AA, and I wanted to run away from what I was doing there. And so I made the excuse that the next day was my son Jerry's ninth birthday that day. And I said, I got to go home for my son's birthday. So I drove back, came in on his ninth birthday, and picked up my last white chip in this very same room. You know, so this room's special to me. I went to a couple of meetings, and I had to go back down there, and I decided, well, regardless of whether I like it or not, I'm going to have to go to meetings. Did not understand the program, had not absorbed very much of it, but I knew that I wanted to do something other than drink. And so I came and started doing things differently. Now, it's really tough when you've got all these things going on in your head that tells you to do this, that, or the other, and these people in AA are telling you to do this, that, or the other, and you've got this conflict, and you think, well, I know more than these people. You know, most of them didn't have a college degree. They weren't in grad school or whatever. What I didn't stop to think about was that these people were sober and I wasn't. And I should pay attention to what they were saying. And I had to argue with myself over and over again that when they told me to do something, I'd say, well, I can't do that. Then I by this time, I'd gotten a sponsor, and he gave me my first copy of the big book. He bought it for me and signed it and everything. And made me read it. In fact, when I got him as a sponsor, he told me there was three meetings I had to go to every week. There was a 12 and 12 meeting on Monday night, a big book study on Wednesday night, and a speaker meeting on Thursday night. He says, the rest of the week, you can do what you want. Now, he meant as far as going to meetings was concerned, you know. But I had to go to those meetings, and I'm very glad because I got into the book. I got to hear a lot of speakers. And sure enough, after a couple of months, I heard a gal tell her story that it just hit home. All the things she talked about when she described her feelings and so on with family and everything and how everything was slipping away. And it just hit me between the eyes. And I went up and talked to her afterwards, you know. And I said, I'm really glad you shared tonight. I said, for the first time, I think I really belong here. You know. And for a while, I just thought it was going to be like every other time I had quit, that I would sooner or later go back to drinking again. That was my habit. But the sponsor I had told me to get into the steps, and sure enough, steps one and two are things that you're supposed to be convinced of, and I was pretty much convinced that I couldn't drink successfully. I missed the medical aspect of alcohol. When things got really bad, I could drink and forget, right? That's what a lot of us used it for, to back out of society. No longer had that, so I had to face up to things. But I did step three, according to what the book said. But when it got there, it said that you need to take this with somebody else that understands what you're doing. But it's better to take it by yourself rather than not take it at all. And I thought it said, Chet, you need to take it by yourself. So I took it by myself. Remember, I was a loner. Didn't want to share that with anybody. I took my first fourth step, and I saw these people that were down there at that time. Some of them had 3 or 4 years and were still on steps 1, 2, and 3. I didn't understand it. In fact, an old timer called it the AA waltz, you know, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, over and over every day. And I talked to another guy, and I said, I need to probably, you know, my sponsor is after me to go on to the fourth step. I said, how many years does it take to do it? He says, about 2 hours. He says, you get you a piece of paper, a legal pad, and sit down, and you write everything that you can put down in 2 hours, I can guarantee you, you're going to hit all of the important things in your life that has happened to you. And I did. I spent somewhere between 2 and 3 hours. I then took a fifth step, and I was afraid to take it with somebody in the program because I'd heard people say that, well, so-and-so that you took your fifth step with got drunk and spilled the beans of everything you said. And I said, well, I don't want that. You know. So I decided to take it with a minister that I knew. And I took it, and when we got through, and it took hours and hours. And when I got through, I remember looking at him. I said, well, what do you think about old Chet now? After I had spilled all these. And I talked with him about things I'd never talked with anyone else about. And he looked back at me and kind of had a little grin on his face. And he just said, welcome to the human race. He had heard most of this stuff before, you know. And I heard a lot of people talk about how good they felt after taking the fifth step. To me, it was kind of like cleaning out a latrine, if you know what a latrine is. I won't describe it any further than that. But that's about what it felt like, you know. Except for one thing. When I walked out of that meeting with him, I felt something I hadn't felt in years. I felt free. I felt free. The stuff I'd been carrying around, I was no longer carrying around, you know. And I didn't realize it until a couple of months later when we were talking, the group of us, and we were talking about the desire to drink, and I happened to start thinking, you know, it's been months since I've had this idea that I was going to go back out and drink again. And I've never wanted to drink since then. That convinced me of the power of the steps right there, and I was only up through step 5. Actually, I guess from that point on, I'd gone on to 6, 7, and probably working on 8. But steps 4 and 5 are still important to me today because it opened up a door. It convinced me more than anything else that this program actually works. And it does. And I firmly believe that today. And I sponsor a lot of guys. And I try to get that across to them. I still go to a step meeting every Thursday night over at my sponsor's house. And I've been doing this for a long time. It's the real secret to this program. You know, it is the program. Well, I'd like to talk a little bit about what I've gained. You know, the book tells us we need to tell what happened. I just did that. But we also need to share about what life is like today. And, you know, things were really rosy there for a while. I think last year we had been married 52 years, and I tell people that we've been happily married for 38 years. Because I drank through the first 12 years. And then the first 2 years of sobriety isn't anything to brag about. I'm here to tell you that, too, because she was not in Al-Anon at that time. And I remember one time coming home, I thought we were going to get divorced. We had talked about getting lawyers and everything else. And I remember one time I was discussing something with her, and I said, well, I can't do this or that. I don't remember what it was. But I remember her looking at me and telling me, as sincere as she could, she says, I wish you were still drinking because I knew who you were then. And I didn't realize how much I had changed already. And I said, I can't do that. I can't go back to drinking. And that was a hard thing to say, you know, because we had 3 sons and a life together, although it was a struggle. And I just thought we were going to wind up getting divorced. And I went back down to Florida and continued working. And then in June of 79, I guess I had about 15 months sobriety at that time. She was going to go up to Kentucky and take the kids with her. And she decided to come down to Florida to let them have a chance to see Florida and then go on up to Kentucky and spend the rest of the summer. And while she was there, I invited a friend of mine over, a gal who had a son about the age of my oldest son. And I said, why don't you come over? We'll have a little cookout. And she came over on a Saturday. And I was in the kitchen fixing stuff up. We had an old apartment at that time. And they were talking. And after everything was over with, my wife pointed out that Susan had asked her to go to an Al-Anon meeting. Now, I had said something about Al-Anon meeting. I even said they even got an Al-Anon meeting over at Napa. And she says, I don't need that. I've got the church. Thank you. I know. Well, this gal presented it differently than I did. You know, sometimes you can hear what you hear from strangers, but you can't hear it from the people you love the most, right? And they went to, she took her to her very first Al-Anon meeting. And by the end of the week, she came home, she had a home group and a sponsor. I mean, she was ready. And she's got 39 years in the program now. And it made a big difference. All of a sudden, we both had something to hang on to. We could discuss things. We could look at each other and say, well, you know, I made a mistake. Or I'm not going to lie about this. And face up to a lot of things. And it made for a new relationship. You know? And I'm very grateful for that today. We are still married and doing well. She has fallen into hard times physically. She had to give up driving about 10 years ago. She's been fighting rheumatoid arthritis for about 30 years now, and it's just taken its toll on her. She doesn't get out to go to meetings anymore. There are some Al-Anons that come over to our place and visit with her. But she also has neuropathy in her lower limbs, and she couldn't control the pedals of the car. And about 2 years ago, I had to get her. You know, I just tell my friends that I bought her an electric car, but what I did was I got her an electric scooter. You know, with a carrier on the back so that she could get out and go to the doctor's offices and that she has to go to periodically. And she would actually go out and do a little bit of shopping. She doesn't even do that much anymore. It just wears her out. You know, after being out for an hour or two, it just wears her out. The disease keeps working, and sometimes she doesn't sleep at all during the night. I wake up the next morning. Of course, I say morning. I guess it's still morning. I get up around 10:30. And she hasn't even been to sleep, you know, because, and I know she has a tough time with that. But her attitude is the thing that I focus on the most, because we still enjoy life together. And we still enjoy doing things together, although it's generally just she and I in the house. I came back from a trip. I was doing a lot of traveling for the last 20 years of my consulting career. And all over the United States, plus Canada and Mexico as well. And I really enjoyed it because I was going around to places like, I taught to a bunch of classes for NASA and a lot of their programmers and GM and a lot of places in the government. And I just enjoyed doing it. And got to go to a lot of interesting places at New Mexico and Arizona and all over the Northeast. But I came home after this one trip where I was gone about 15 days, I guess. I'd gone out to New Mexico and back, and I stopped for a visit in Texas as well. And I came home, and she hadn't been out of bed except to go to the bathroom for about 3 or 4 days, had not been eating. She was depressed, and I realized that I really cannot leave her by herself anymore. She had gotten to the point where she would fall occasionally and she'd break toes and so on. And I think she's broken every toe on each foot except for the two big toes. I used to tell people that's because she hadn't kicked me hard enough yet, but you know, that's probably going to happen one of these days. But I had to take over responsibilities of doing the household things. I told her she couldn't go up and down the steps anymore because I was afraid if she would fall, she would really injure herself, break a hip or break part of her spine. She had low calcium in 3 or 4 different areas of her body. And so I started learning how to do the laundry. I did the shopping. I still do the cooking. And I've actually become a pretty good cook. A couple of times in the last couple of months, I fixed some things for her. She said, you know, that's the best I've ever had of this. And I tasted it. Yeah, it tastes pretty good, you know. But I'm using her recipes, though. I've changed my title from computer engineer to domestic engineer. You know, and I enjoy that. I didn't think that I would. If you had asked me 5 years ago that I would like to have stayed home and done the cooking and the cleaning and things like that, I'd have said no. But you see, that's one of the things I've gotten from this program. Some of you all probably remember Bill Roop. You remember him? An old-timer. He had like 56 years when he passed away. But I used to go to a lot of meetings with Bill and his wife, Jan. And in her latter years, she had gotten dementia and finally wound up being bedridden. And he would take care of her. She had bed sores and so on. And he would always clean up after her, rather than have somebody else come in and do it. And he was old, you know, older than me. And he would help her. And he wouldn't do it in a way that he was bragging. He would simply say, it was a matter-of-fact thing. Well, I had to do this or I had to do that. And he said it was service. You know? And what I'm doing with my wife is not nearly what he was doing for his wife. But I'm here to tell you that when you do things with love and service in mind, it changes the whole picture. It really does, you know. Those of you who have gotten sober and you want a way to improve your sobriety, there's two things I can throw at you. One is sponsorship. You should have a sponsor by now. But sponsoring other people is a way of making you grow in this program unlike any other. I remember one of the first guys I sponsored, by the way, he's got 38 years now, still sober. And I can't take credit for that, because he would come and ask me things and I'd say, well, let's look in the book for that. And I had no idea what he was talking about. And I learned a lot, you know, by going back through the book. The other is service. And I got into service first as a GSR and then as a DCM. I served as a DCM 4 times, two full terms and 2 part terms. One guy quit one time. Another guy passed away and I filled in for him. But I also served as program chair for the last 2 state conventions we've had here in Atlanta back in 2005 and 2013, and I enjoyed that greatly. And you don't get a single penny for that, you know. But if you want a better life in AA, I suggest you try service. You know, it will make you grateful. It really will. What other benefits have I had? Well, when I was about 6 years sober, one of the toughest things I ever had to face in life was my oldest son, Jerry, at the time, he was 15. He went on a camping trip and he fell off a cliff and died. And I remember taking a guy with me that I sponsored. And we went up. We thought they might be able to find him. And by the time we got up there, they found out that he was dead. And I remember calling the house and I called a few other people to let them know what was going on. And by the time we drove back, it was like a 2-hour drive. And by the time we got back, my house was filled with people in the program. It was amazing. They helped. They walked with us through that. There was a friend of mine that was in Athens, and I remember his mom had just passed away, and I called him, and I said, what do I need to do here to get ready for all the things that happen after somebody dies? And he started trying to tell me over the phone. He said, never mind. He says, I'll come down and visit you tomorrow. And he took a day of vacation just to come in to visit with me and walk me through all the things I needed to do, preparation for it. Some of y'all may remember Father Noel. He passed away last year, but at the time he was the Monsignor of the Catholic Church in this area, and I'm not even Catholic, you know. And I went up to him and I said, I need somebody to lead a memorial service for my son. And this was the week of Easter. And he says, you realize this is our High Holy Week? He says, I have got everything scheduled this week. I said, I don't know who else to ask. He found time. He came and did it. You know, I remember that funeral because, or that memorial service, because there were people where my son had worked, where my wife had worked, where I had worked. Our son's schoolmates and so on were all there, and a whole bunch of people from AA and Al-Anon. And everybody else was really somber except for the guys from AA and Al-Anon. We were enjoying life because, as the Monsignor had said when he talked, he said we're here to celebrate the love that we had for this boy. And it was that. I could tell you about one really important meeting. I was attacked when I was about 15 years sober, and I was stabbed 4 or 5 times by a couple of thugs and taken to a hospital on a Friday night. By the time my wife got there, she thought she'd never see me again. They had to cut all my clothes off, and I had a punctured lung, and they had to repair it, all kinds of things. They stabbed all the way around. They were trying to get money from me, but I didn't have much. But I was in surgery for like 8 hours, I think. And then when they brought me out of surgery, I remember going down this hallway, and it was filled with, once again, AAs and Al-Anons. My wife's sponsor and her husband were there, and the guy, my sponsor and his wife were there, and probably about another 2 dozen people. I didn't know how bad I had been hurt. I was thinking I would get up the next day and go teach my Saturday morning class over at DeKalb Tech. But they had made a lot of repairs, even including in the stomach and the large and small intestines. And I didn't know how bad it was. And I remember I had all these tubes running in and out of me. And they found out about it at the Tuesday night meeting. And they came up on Wednesday night. And I was still in intensive care. And this guy got a bunch of people to come up to give me a meeting. One of the best meetings I've ever been to in my life. I was in a private room, and a nurse came in. It was only supposed to be 2 people in the room at a time. There was like about 15 people. They were sitting on the floor, and they were around the walls. And a nurse looked in and says, "Are you all right?" And I said, "Yes, ma'am, I am." I didn't know it at the time, but they were talking about operating on me again because nothing was working. They kept feeding me food, and it just turned green or gray and come right back up, you know, and nothing was going through. The next morning, things started working. I said, "Well, we're going to put off the surgery." And I said, "What surgery?" Next morning, they came in and checked once again. They said, "Well, he's doing all right. Let's move him out of this room." So they took all the tubes away, put me into a regular room. I tell people today, that's the time I quit smoking, by the way. I do not want to go through that effort of them trying to blow your lung back up again. Anybody's ever gone through that, that's not a pleasant thing. But I remember that that's the closest I've ever been to death. But when I was drinking, I used to fear death tremendously. And when I was in this situation, I didn't feel any pain. I didn't feel any fear. I felt like I was in God's hands. You know? And I still feel that way today. I'm so grateful for this program, for people like you. I hope you find something in what I said here tonight that will help you. You know, if you're slacking off in your program, my best recommendation for you is to get off your ass and get to work. You know, thank you very much.
Wow. That's my friend. That's cool. Actually, you want to know something scary? I ran the computers that he programmed. And the company that he talked about, that he worked for, I worked for 17 years, and they paid $20,000 for me to go to Peachford a long time ago, 28 years ago.
They didn't offer me that.
I know. Well, they didn't offer it. They said, "Don't do it again." They said, "You get one shot."
My name is Tinsley. I'm an alcoholic. Thanks, Chet, so much for your story. I've been looking forward to this a long time, and this truly is a program that works in rough going, and your story really showed that.
Tinsley, I think the Brookhaven police are out working on our membership program as we speak.
Okay. Thank you one and all for joining the Leadership Speakers Meeting tonight.
First I slip and then I crept to a hope-filled dream. You rescue me and finally waking there I see. I look into love's window for a soul that's meant for me. Takes me where the promises are real. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slow, we get just what we need. On a broad highway, stride for stride, we walk eternally. Look into love's window for a heart that beats for me. Takes me where the promises are real. And I always long for something to set me free. Where the promises are.